I hope you'll prompt us.
We talk loud.
Choice? Hi, I'm Arnie Katz. My wingmen here are Bill Kunkel and Joyce Worley. I think you all know who we are, but for the one or two who don't, we were the folks who started the video and computer game field with Electronic Games Magazine back in 81. We also have designed games, consulted on games, awarded prizes to games, answered questions about games, and I guess done just about everything you can do in this business. But what we're really here to talk about today is something that mixes our interest in gaming with another interest that the three of us all share, which is collecting. And although there's no question that people are here at the fifth annual Classic Games Expo, fourth Classic Games Expo, fifth event overall, because we love the games, we love to play them, we love to look at them, we love to talk about them. There's also the element of collecting, and as I say, that's what we're going to talk about today. This is a relatively new field for video and computer games, though of course collecting is about as old as human society. A collecting authority that I know, actually it was this guy here, once said, everything is collectible. And I've been trying to find something that people don't collect, and I'm having a very tough time at this point. You would not believe some of the things people collect. There are people who have gigantic collections of air sickness bags. This is true. They buy them, sell them, and trade them just like we do the games and so forth. But the collecting is a fairly new concept for video and computer gaming. And really, the initial impetus was something that's a little foreign to collecting, and that is content collecting. Whereas most collectors in other fields are looking for objects, talismans, whatever you want to call them, artifacts from bygone eras that have a resonance either personally in the form of nostalgia or societally in the form of connecting to some great event like World War II or Elvis Presley, for example. But in gaming, the initial impetus was to get the games so that we could play them. And now we've moved into another phase where most of the video games are now readily available in emulation mode, and of course the computer games are easily copied. It's nothing to copy a piece of computer software, technically. So really, while we are all content collectors, what we're here to talk about today is collecting everything but the game. To a real collector, the box that the game is in is more collectible than the game. If the box were sealed in shrink wrap and there was a blank disc inside, it would be worth basically the same as if it had the game on the disc, because the game is infinitely reproducible. It's much along the lines of music collecting. You can collect all the songs of Elvis Presley or Hank Williams, and that's pretty easy to do these days. You can buy a DVD set that probably has everything you want, but more interesting to many people and much more varied are all the side items. In the case of video games, this would include everything from a football and a bat. This is from Major League MLB 2001, or a whistle from The Last Express, and generic company things like the Activision Gravity Pen. You can see this comes out and stays in. Many companies are addicted to swords and stones. This is probably the first one that was given out. This goes from Accolade. Here's a slightly different take on the same idea from Legends of Excalibur. And in any case, there are a lot of promotional items. There are magazines, there is box art, there is original artwork, there are pins. The list really goes on and on. Bill and Joyce and I have brought a rather wide variety of materials in so you could see it. And in fact, even the bag that I brought it in, which is a Nintendo bag, is collectible in that it has this very nice cloth Nintendo patch on it. So truly anything is collectible. There within collecting, there has to be some distinctions made. For example, a lot of companies, Disney was very big on this, would take a standard Disney item and slap a sticker on it, and that was what they would hand out to the press, to retailers, and so forth as promotional items.
A lot of these too. A lot of the
right
pog shooters,
right,
and Nerf guns,
things like that. A lot of things like that. This is a Smurf that was handed out, the same kind of thing. But that kind of while those things are often collectible, they're not really gaming collectibles. Much more valuable are the items that were made specifically to be about one game or one company. A hockey puck from Activision Ice Hockey, for example. If this was just a hockey puck that said NHL, then it would just be a sports collectible. But the fact that it's themed to a particular game makes it a true gaming collectible. At this point, gaming collecting is in its infancy. This is the time to buy those things that recall to you those days when you were playing the Atari and the ColecoVision and the Intellivision and the Astrocade and all those great things that we did. Now is the hour when these things are still fairly reasonable. There was an auction here yesterday, and of course, there's always eBay, there are stores, there are private collectors, there are even websites traffic in these things. It would be impossible if we had 10 hours to discuss the full shape of the collecting field. Joyce and I have a book on collecting pop culture coming out this fall, which will in part touch on video games, and Bill and I are working on a video games collectible book, which we hope will be published next spring. And speaking of Bill, I know he has quite a bit he'd like to say, and before I hog all the time, I'd like to turn it over to Bill Kunkel.
Thank you. I've always been a connoisseur of this stuff. I mean, you know, when you've been going to CES since 1981, you come up with a lot of stuff. And they've always, the game industry used to be very good to you. I gather they haven't been as good in recent years about handing out stuff. One of the first pieces I ever got was this Pitfall jacket, which you can actually see on Good Deal Games. If you go up there, there's a picture of it. They actually give out safari jackets. Sega, as recently as, whenever Knights came out, made a Jester's hat available.
And expected to wear it.
This is a stuffed animals, another big area. There are a lot. The Japanese were especially into these. There's a whole set of Sonic. In fact, we got, I think, one over there. Yeah.
And there's a Bubsy Bobcat.
And the smaller
Donkey
ones. Yeah.
Kong.
This is the only one of these in America, by the way. This was for a game that was never actually released in the United States, but Laurie managed to con it out of Misawa. We got tie-ins. Rainforest Crunch did a tie-in with a character I'm sure none of you remember, called Awesome Possum. And here he is on the cover. It's, you know, like a Donkey Kong cereal box. It's collectible.
This is not to be confused with the Awesome Blossom at Chili's.
Right. Socks. Now, you wouldn't think you'd get socks as at a video game convention, but I not only get socks, I get shoelaces from Accolade. Shot glasses, very popular. Obviously, you know, the game crowd,
the more
is a drinking
you drink,
crowd.
The better the game seems, yeah.
And if you need something to put in the shot glass, Microsoft was good enough to give out bottled Brainwash at a show they did where they had Gwar in concert. And of course, you need a coaster for all this crap. You go to a coin-op show and somebody like Rockola will give you a coaster. Never say that the game field doesn't know its audience. A pocket protector from from Lester the Unlikely, appropriately enough. I've got about 10,000 keychains. I will never have enough keychains in my entire life, enough keys in my entire life to put on all the keychains that I have.
And you'll never be in enough wars to use up all the dog tags.
That's true, yeah. But they do find sometimes really practical items. Berkeley actually produced this mighty threesome, a plunger, toilet paper, and a scrubber for Twisted. I'm not making any of this stuff up. Squeeze balls, enormously popular. For whatever reason, like 1 year, somebody did a squeeze ball, and the next year, everybody had squeeze balls. This is a Havoc squeeze ball, and I got about 20 of them at home in different games. Yeah. This is one of the oldest items that I have in my collection. Accolade was very good. They were really had a lot of foresight, along with Activision, putting out stuff. This is a beautiful Bubble Ghost paperweight, clear glass. They also, when they were giving this out, gave out, yeah, I think you can see it over there, Bubble Ghost bubbles. So you could actually blow bubbles. Some of the items are really incredibly appropriate. Atari's hard driving, they gave out an actual wear around your neck hard driving timer.
Race driving, sorry.
So that you could time yourself while you were playing video games, I guess. My all-time least favorite collectible, and this is an example of the kind of crap that I really take offense at. And if you wonder why Capstone isn't in business anymore, this is as good as an example as you'll ever see. They did a Homie the Clown game. Okay, great idea for a license right off the top. They then go out and buy a bunch of cheap clown noses and have the gall to put a sticker on it that says, Capstone Nose, you'll love Homie D. Clown. I don't know why I still have it. Here's an appropriate item. An Astron belt. Anybody remember Astron belt from Sega? It was a old coin-op back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. This is an Astron belt buckle. Not making any of this up. Lego had a software thing, Lego City or something at one point, and they gave out a whole series of these little movable Lego keychains with the characters whose limbs moved. Articulated figures, amazing. When Chessmaster came out, they sent this. This used to have chocolate in it, but I ate the chocolate, so forget about that.
So it's not much of a collectible anymore.
No, less than you would think.
It's a little less now.
And if anybody needs a hand, I've got several of them. This was given out with, Flesh Feast? Yeah,
Flesh
Sega
Feast.
Soft's Flesh Feast. You may not remember the game, but you'll never forget this piece. Sega also, obviously being obsessed with limbs and appendages, released this prize item here with the N64 crossed out, and it used to say Sega across the fingers here, but that just blurred. You know, those prison tattoos don't last. We got a kit, Journey to the Edge travel kit, Kuala Lumpur. I don't even know what's in here. Oh yeah, it's got a dead fly. And for emergencies,
little emergencies, actually.
Very tiny emergencies, the tiniest roll of toilet paper in the world.
Somehow sending flies, though, is a little like coals to Newcastle, isn't it?
Yes. I'm thirsty now, so I'm going to drink out of my VR Sports water bottle. Ah! Nothing better.
That is the same water that was... No, it's really not. It's really not.
This was another thing that got in vogue for a while, were these slider puzzles. Several companies gave these things out. A lot of companies gave out these glow-in-the-dark for an hour pieces. You know, break it and it'll glow in the dark, but what you didn't know is that it was only going to last about 45 minutes. However, I've got a blinking Tex Murphy button that's been blinking since I've got it, and I got it at least 7 years ago, so the hell of a battery in that thing. Obviously, golf balls, Pens in all forms.
Oh, all forms.
Baseball bats, hockey sticks.
Pens that look like carrots.
Yeah.
I have several of those from different games. For some reason, a lot of games involve carrots, and so there are a lot of kind of generic carrots that are, they pass out these carrots. Now, what am I supposed to do with these stuffed carrots? I have no idea, but I got them.
Plastic carrots. Then there is the totally inexplicable item that's cool nonetheless, but I've never been able to figure out why Sega gave out gold mini Slinkies. If anybody can tell me, Sega was not able to tell me at the time, so I doubt anybody will. I guess they just got a bunch of gold small Slinkies and stuck little Sega things on them and gave them out.
And of course, that is exactly the kind of non-gaming collectible. Really, the thing that's collectible about it is the little sticker.
Yeah, the little Sega
thing. The only collectible
aspect
is the sticker. Without the sticker, it's one of about, 10 million.
Obviously, game companies feel people stab one another a lot because knives are a
perennial. And they think we have a lot of hair because sometimes the switchblade knife turns out to be a switchblade comb.
Yes. And Velma's invariably. I've never gotten a real switchblade, damn it.
And they think we've got a lot of letters to open.
Tons of letter openers.
We're ready.
the neatest one I got recently was, a claim. Sent out a little samurai sword sitting on a rest.
Yeah.
Sweet
very
little
cute
item.
Looking.
Let's see what else we got here. Lunchbox. These were rather popular. This is the only metal one I ever got. And it's funny, often the bigger the collectible, the bigger the bomb, the game that goes with it. Anybody remember Disruptor from Universal?
Sure. Here's another one they want to mention. You're saying we didn't have good knives.
Oh,
here's one.
This is a full Swiss Army knife for Lynx. So when you go golfing, you'll have a knife with
if
you.
If you don't do well, you just eliminate the rest of the foursome. No witnesses. You can say what you scored, whatever you want.
As for sports, SegaSoft gave out bowling bags with three dirty dwarves. With a bowling pin inside. Okay, now figure that one out. I have not yet figured out what I'm supposed to do with it. It sits in the corner of my office, and I think, God, that's one of the weirdest collectibles I've got.
And, of course, we all have use for a blue and black football, just sitting around the office.
This is one of the sweetest pieces at a Sega day. They gave out these denim jackets with a Sega on the front as well. I mean, I figured a denim jacket alone is probably worth about $70. Some real cute stuff. The Road Rash 2 leather jacket key holder. I mean, it's just the people who think this stuff up deserve points. Lots of pads. I mean, obviously writers write a lot. Journalists write a lot.
Clocks.
So got
many clocks.
Oh, clocks. We've got clocks. Especially when CDs came out, because then they could just stick the CD up there and put a couple of hands on it and a clock movement behind it, and bang, you had a clock collectible.
Many clocks. Speaking of clocks, though, reminds me of our third partner who's been sitting here, I guess, napping. Joyce is our reigning expert on handhelds, portables, watches, and so forth, and she's brought in quite a few collectibles and is going to tell us a little bit about the special challenges and rewards of collecting that kind of material.
Handhelds and tabletop games came into their own in 1980 to 82. It started with such things as Fidelity's Fortune Teller, which worked on cards that inserted, you ask a question, and then they would give you wisdom.
A great piece.
Hold it for you. Want me to hold it for you?
No. Wildfire was the first electronic handheld, or tabletopper in this case, that actually attempted to make an adult game in a child's surrounding. It played a very credible game of pinball, and it sort of inspired a lot of the designers to understand what they could go on and do from that point.
They used a traveling matrix, didn't they, Joyce, where the dots lit up in sequence
That's
as your
right.
pinball
they
traveled
were doing
around?
It the hard way then. Mike Katz was with Mattel at that time. He took one look at it and he said, well, we should do something with this technology. And he brought out the first true adult handheld, which was a small football game. Actually, he ended up bringing out four of them, football, baseball, a couple of other sports. Then he went over to Coleco and helped develop the ColecoVision. Handhelds in 1980, 81, 82 were very simple. The background, what you would think of as the background graphics, were painted on the glass. And LCD technology played a very primitive game. These were really not a good play at all, but there were hundreds of them made during that period of time. A collector is going to want to watch for how handsome the cabinet is, because unfortunately the circuitry at this point is well over 20 years old, and you will find that most of them will not work. Even if they have good circuitry, you'll have difficulty with the batteries because they weren't standardized at this time. Handhelds did, however, develop. They became more conscious of play action. Some very righteous game people got into it, such as Andy Rissman over at Tiger. This one is the first move into double screen. This is Minor 2049er, and the gameplay literally moved into the second screen. Nintendo went on and did one better, where it folded out three times, but as you can imagine, the screens kept getting smaller and smaller. The amount of action on each section of screen became smaller, and they weren't really as much fun to play as they should have been. Randy Rissman, though, was a real game player, and that's why Tiger did better on theirs. The age of the table topper, we've all seen the ColecoVision mini arcades, and then the Nintendo mini arcades that sort of copied what Nintendo had done, what Coleco had done. A lot of other companies made them as well and went into sleeker, more designy, more modern form with much, much better play action, where you could actually get a good game out of it.
That's
there were
my
also
favorite.
The
That's my favorite.
Yeah.
Yes, this was a doll. I also like Scramble very
yeah.
much. Wonderful play action in that game. Tomy, same people who make toys, went into 3D. This pair of goggles focused on the game screen in the back. Light came in through this window on top, and it made a very handsome 3D game. Unfortunately, the circuitry is down on all of these. A collector can pick these up now for rock bottom prices. It's obvious that they're going to continue to increase as people begin to realize the significance of them. And if you're a fiddler, you can open them up and kind of gently work over the contacts with the soft side of an emery board, and you just might get lucky enough to restore it to life. There were also oddities, and this might be the most peculiar one that came out. This is called a Pomtex. The company, is a prototype, never did work well at all, and the company never got it to market, but it was made to work with little slide-in programmable games. They just simply couldn't get the technology working for them soon enough to get it to market. They went to a CES, and the people who were trying to promote it literally came to a fist fight on the last day of CES, right in the middle of the aisle.
Oh,
it was very entertaining for all of us, and in fact, that was the best thing about the game.
Livened up that show.
I strongly encourage anybody who is interested in collecting real weird things that will become more valuable in a period of time to look into handhelds and table toppers. They're still cheap, everybody who tries to sell you one will say, oh yeah, it works so far as I know. Well, they're lying. Take some batteries with you in your pocket and give it a test. Pick it up cheap, take it home and fiddle with it. If I can do it, you can probably make it work a lot better even than I could.
Okay.
Questions?
Yeah, I think that, as I said, we could sit here and talk about collectibles and trot out items, but I'm sure you folks have some questions, and we'd like to use the rest of this session to answer them. Bill will call on people and
and in the Game Doctor tradition, Lori will be handing out Game Doctor prize packs to people who ask interesting questions. Yes. It really varied from company to company. Nintendo, for example, has always been incredibly stingy with their collectibles. I mean, getting
which makes them more valuable.
Yes, getting something out of them was like pulling teeth. Sega, on the other hand, extremely generous. In Japan, you know, it's very much the corporate culture of the company that dictates that kind of stuff. And again, a lot of it was desperation because Sega was number two most of the time and Nintendo was number one, so Nintendo didn't have to go that extra mile. They were very good to retailers and distributors, but to journalists, they weren't quite so generous. And in Japan, a lot of stuffed animals, a lot of pins. I remember, no one will ever forget the E3 where Nintendo actually had a giant cannon that fired out Pokemons, okay? This was before Pokemon was Pokemon, okay? And they had to stop doing it because fights were breaking out on the floor over these things.
Well, our game tester sprained his wrist.
That's right. Ken Vance, our game tester, sprained his wrist in a scramble in a scrum on the floor trying to obtain one of them. So, I think they were very largely influenced by a lot of the American stuff. But you don't get really weird stuff until an American PR company takes over. That's when you start getting really, that's when you start getting the hands.
I think that mostly the Japanese companies have done what any intelligent corporate entity would do in dealing with the U.S. market. They tried to deal with it in a way that would be relevant, and that meant if Infocom was giving out little premium items, well, they were going to give them out too. As Bill says, though, the Japanese items are often slicker, but also often adapted from something else, where there are quite a few very original items done in America.
Yes.
Well, I think there's always a market in collecting. There's always an interest in collecting for the memorabilia, for something that never was, you know. The music equivalent is posters for the New Year's Day concert that Hank Williams didn't give because he was dead, or the concert that Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Richie Valens didn't give because of the plane crash. And in gaming, as you say, we have quite a few games that, well, the hype was as far as the company got. So there are quite a few items out there that are gaming collectibles, but there's no game that you can then go play.
This is a magic wand from SegaSoft, Fractured Fairy Tales, The Frog Prince. Never happened, but I've got a magic wand out of it.
I would say at CES, you probably one out of every 20 games that you're seeing will never come to market. After all, part of what they're doing at CES is testing the market response, and if it's not good, well, they'll kill the project right then. And of course, sometimes they can't bring it in.
And of course, there's another kind of collectible that we really haven't touched on too much, and that is the paper collectibles, the press kits,
the ad slicks.
The point of sale posters, and many of these things were done up to use at E3, or if you want to go back, you know, about a decade to CES. But of course, if, as Joy says, if the game was not commercially viable if they didn't get those advance orders. Well, it never got beyond the posters.
Pair of handcuffs from Police Quest.
I have so many pairs of handcuffs.
A lot of handcuffs.
People must come to my house and say, wow, there's an S&M freako.
Yes.
Okay, I was talking more in terms of ad slicks, which are separate, usually eight and a half by 11 or 8 by 10 glossy paper items. I think with magazines, the general wisdom has got to be keep your magazines intact.
Yeah.
If you're really serious about collecting magazines, invest in some of the storage things that have been perfected for the comic book industry. Because the magazines, while they are on better paper, some of them are anyway, than, say, Superman comics from 1955, they still will deteriorate. You want to keep them out of sunlight. Now, I think there's one place where I think there could be a lot of argument is whether you want them autographed, and if so, by who. I know that Joyce, Bill, and I have signed more than our share of covers of Electronic Games magazine, and I always sign when I'm asked. But in my own mind, I'm not totally sure that it's worth more that way. Sometimes I think that if you've got a mint copy, it's not a bad thing to keep it that way. Because when people sign, after a while, the ink begins to spread. It may even soak through to other pages. And going by collectibles in other fields, for example, baseball cards, where cards that have gum stains from the era when baseball cards came with gum are considerably less valuable than cards that are pristine. So I think that the watchword for magazines is keep them whole, keep them as much as possible, if you're serious about just the collecting value, unread. Now, I personally only like, I have collectibles because I love them. So any collectible I buy, if it came in a box, I'm opening the box. But if you're looking for value and future appreciation, then you're really going to have to leave them unread and in mint condition.
I'd like to add to that. If you look at other collectibles, say a Jack Benny ad slick from a magazine in the 1930s, it's worth maybe $20-$25 maximum. If you have the entire magazine, you'll probably get $50 to $100 for it. A lot of times, if you get serious about checking out what things are worth, look at some other more established field of collecting and see what has happened over the decades. Collecting in the game field is really new, and we're establishing now what will be the mode in the future.
Yes?
Well, in our case, of course, they were given to us at the time. You know, somebody from Sega said, you want a pin? And I don't remember Joyce, Bill, or I ever saying no. Now, we had a friend who was also a journalist at the time, a fellow named Russ Sokola, who some of you may remember. And he used to do his tour of CES and later E3 with a shopping basket on wheels He would empty it three times a day.
And he got sponsored. He got the different companies would sponsor that basket
the
on
basket.
Different days.
Exactly.
So it'd be a Sega basket one day. And
But today he probably has one of the great collections. He also has something that really none of us up here have, and that is that he got an unopened copy of every game. And he left it unopened, usually in its shrink wrap. So he has all of those marvelous boxes that are, as I said earlier, really worth more than the piece of software that was in them at the time.
Arnie, however, in the great E3 Rory will beat Russ Sokola match, I came up with one collectible that he did not. And he spent 3 hours at the booth trying to get another stuffed animal from Imagineer.
Well, you know, like many collectors, Russ is just
a little bit compulsive.
I remember seeing him walking along with that damn shopping basket so heavy he couldn't move it.
Russ would show up without a coat at the shows, because then one of the first companies he would visit would say, you need a jacket or something, so they'd give him a jacket. Yes, or a tie.
Well, although once in another lifetime, somebody one company gave Bill a whole suit.
That's right, Coleco.
Coleco gave Bill a suit. They didn't like his suit when he appeared on Good Morning America.
Well, it's because I wasn't wearing one.
Well, they didn't like it.
And they felt it was inappropriate to be
so
doing
they gave
television
him a suit.
Shows without a suit. So they gave me a suit, yes. I never wore it. It's mint.
Of course, there is another answer. For the kind of thing that I'm talking about, you do find a lot in yard sales. It's worth poking through the junk to see what's there.
And also, I've got cards here. Anybody who's interested in a lot of this stuff, just pick up a card and contact me. It can all be bought, and I'm not looking for a lot of money for these things, honestly. I'd just rather see them get out there.
Right.
I rather than sitting in boxes in my house, I'd rather see them on somebody's desk who's going to enjoy them.
Exactly. I think that at this point, we feel it's kind of incumbent on us as people who have a lot of this material to help the market by, well, really dispersing them among to other collectors so that everyone can get some of it. The fact is that promotional items, that is the items that were given to retailers, journalists, and other people within the industry to promote the distribution of a new item, those items are just about impossible to pick up at, say, a yard sale, and they're even going to be very rare at eBay. Ultimately, I suspect that the auctions held at this event each year will become a major conduit for that kind of material.
And with two shows now, with one in Philly as well as one here, there's now twice a year people can go in there and really collect.
I think we have time for a couple more.
You don't get a prize, another prize.
In fact, we take back the first prize if we don't like this one. Actually, Bill's got a very good story about this. He was telling it to me yesterday, so I know he's going to tell it to you now.
Yes, actually, to my knowledge, these folks here, GamersOnline.com, were the first folks at an actual industry event to have. I was going to put this in one of the game bags, right? And I check, and I want to make sure it's not trick matches and a kid isn't going to get in and blow himself up or set himself on fire. And I open it up and there's a prophylactic inside. So this reminded me of the time I was in San Francisco on a panel. It was one of those high-tech things. And I was on the panel with a guy from Penthouse Magazine. And at the time, Penthouse had just developed its own software division. And they were going around handing out, their giveaway was a slick little condom. And one of the other guys on the program with me was a guy from Intel. And he said, he looked at it and he said, "My God, if only we thought to use that for our Intel Inside campaign."
Mm. Well, you know, being a journalist, you know, we used to cover E3 and CES. They were marathons. We would start it at 6 in the morning, and we would finish at midnight and go back and do it the next day. And, you know, there is a certain comfort level knowing that if they're going to be sticking it to us, at least they're using a condom.
No, I'm making it up as we go along. If you can get the box and the instructions, obviously that adds value. The battery requirement, well, if you're lucky and you're getting one of the newer ones, it'll be 4 AA's or 2 C's. However, on the others, they're completely non-standard hearing aid.
You may want to check a battery store.
Battery stores say that they can match anything. I don't know if that's really true or not, but it's worth a try.
I'd also say that, again, as sometimes happens, there is a split between the collectors and the players. As players, we want to rip open the box. I know I do. and play those games. The collector would say that you should leave it in the box with its instructions and anything else that came with it. That would be the item with the highest value for that item. Though I think that you will find that one of the things that makes those items still in box with pristine instructions so rare is that there are a lot more game lovers than there are collectors.
If I can add to that, there's a lot of rule of thumb and good common sense. The Coleco mini arcades that we're also familiar with, boy, those were beautiful things, but they sold over 100,000 of every one of them. So they are less valuable than, for example, this Q-bert, which didn't sell at all. So far as I know, the most valuable standalone game, other than the Vectrex, is the Crazy Climber that used two little miniature joysticks to make the man climb. The fact that there were two, you put pressure on those joysticks, making him climb, and they snapped.
So if you see one, go for it!
Of those.
And folks, I think we're just about out of time. They wanted us to move along. I want to thank you all for showing up. And if you've got any more questions, we'll be here. We'll be around. Please feel free.
Enjoy the convention. Thank you very much for coming, everybody.